Committee on State Government, Innovation, and Veterans will be in order. Today is Wednesday, April 27, 2011. First item on the agenda will be Senate File 16. We're going to be out of order here as we have authors coming in and out because I know we have conference committees going on. So, Senator Wigger, welcome to that side of the table of the committee.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair, committee members. Senate File 16 is a resolution to Congress asking that there be an appointment of an independent counsel for a full accounting of those persons that have been missing in action, POWs missing in action. Nearly 90,000 persons are in that category, and of the hundreds of thousands that have so honorably served our country, gone off to war, there are thousands, tens of thousands, that are still unaccounted for. And I have several people that are here in support of the measure and from the various service organizations, and I want to mention in my own community in the North St. Paul, Maywood, Oakdale area, each year in September we have a march from the VFW to the Legion to commemorate the POWs and the MIAs and the Candlelight Vigil. And one person that couldn't be here today is Stan Crusher Kowalski.
And I was hoping for that one, Senator Wigger.
And he wanted to, but he's thinking about us. He wanted to give his greetings, his strong support. But we also were very pleased to have Richard Skillstead. And Richard, to my left, is the National POW MIA Director of the group called 40 and 80. And he'll tell you about that and about their organization's strong support for this measure. So, Mr. Chair, I'd like to introduce Richard Skillstead.
Welcome, sir. Please state your name for the record, and you may proceed.
Thank you. Richard Skillstead from Yoda, Minnesota, and I'm the National POW MIA Director for the 40 and 8. Now, the 40 and 8 stands for when we, in World War I, when we went across France, it was 40 soldiers or 8 horses in a boxcar. Now, you've been hearing some on POWs, not always is the 40 in there. They're 60 to 80, so they're cramped in pretty bad. But as when we were the 40 and 8, we were more comfortable. We want to make our soldiers easier for them. And we decided on several programs. Our main program, why I'm here today, is the POW MIA. I'm an advocate for that. What them soldiers went through is unbelievable. Some of them didn't make it, I know that, but a lot of them have. Therefore, our MIAs is the main cause right now. We have, I got them wrote down here, about 78,000 for World War II, 8,300 for Korea, Vietnam is 1,800, Gulf War is 3, current conflict is 12. Yes, we do have POWs in Iraq right now. The JPAC out of Hawaii started out in 2003, and they found over 1,600 MIAs already. But we want to continue on and get them back to our loved to their loved ones so they can be buried properly. And I'm hoping that you support this bill 100%. I'm not sure how many other veterans are in here in the room for you senators, but I do have John Austin here, Bill Bourne, Roger Ball, and Jim Hamilton are with this organization, and they are could testify with me stating that that is one of our programs, and I'm very happy to be part of it, and what I do is we have a committee, first of all, nationwide. We give out scholarships for these POWs' families, spouse, children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren. Last year, we gave out 19 scholarships, over $15,250, what we gave for the scholarships. I'm hoping, pleading, whatever. We do need this bill because we still have some from Minnesota and Vietnam. I believe it's 59 still MIAs in Vietnam.
Right.
I'd surely love to get them home. Then, naturally, All of them. Last year, there was 6 World War I MIAs found in France in a barn. They got them home. I said, thank you. I'd like to say thank you for all what you're doing, and I'm hoping we can get more of them home. I know it costs money, but what doesn't anymore? So, right. But at that, thank you. If you have any questions, please feel free to ask me or Senator here, and we'll help you out as much as we can.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Skillingston. Let the record know that we do have a quorum present. Senator Wigger, any questions for the testifier? Senator Wigger, do you have any other testifiers? Or,
Mr. Chair, members, there are several here in support, and Mr. Skillingston mentioned their names,
all
and
right.
There's several resolutions of support from the various organizations. I believe this is a friendly committee for this, and in the interest of time and that there is your support for it, I would conclude our testimony at this point.
Senator Wigger, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File 16 be recommended pass and referred to the floor. It may have to go to rules.
Go to rules.
Yes.
All right.
Rules.
Senator Wigger moves Senate File 16 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Rules and Administration. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Passes, and we will send it on. Thank you, sir. Our second item on the agenda will be Senate File 943, Senator Ingebrigtsen. And while Senator Ingebrigtsen comes up here, Mr. Bodern, could you take a moment and describe for us why this particular bill is in front of this committee?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. Primarily, there are a number of rulemaking provisions in the bill that bring it to the State Government Committee. And I'll just take you very quickly through each section. Beginning with Section 3, which is on page 2, this relates to state procurement law and provides an exemption from the limitations on amounts that can be exchanged without a cash transaction occurring for private aquaculture businesses. Then, if you look on page 5, in that lengthier paragraph at the top there, paragraph B, this provides the Commissioner of Natural Resources with the authority to direct some alternative testing methods for VHS and aquatic farms and exempts it from rulemaking provisions. There are a number of other provisions like that. The next is on page 11 in section 26 of the bill. This relates to fees that can be charged for duplicate stamps for producing and mailing pictorial stamps. And provides a number of exemptions, including in that last sentence on 11.25, an exemption from rulemaking.
Did you say 27 or 26?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. It's section 26, as shown on page 11 of the bill, the last sentence in that section. Then on page 12, section 30 basically amends some rulemaking authority for the commissioner relating to rules that establish turkey seasons and how licenses for turkey seasons shall be issued. And on page 17, and I think this is a different one, it's there is also an authorization for, on line 17.23 in section 43, authorization for rulemaking for the commissioner concerning taking elk that are causing damage or nuisance. Then on page 18 of the bill, section 47 relates to mid-season adjustments on the Mille Lacs Lake and allows an exemption from rulemaking authority or rulemaking requirements in order to accomplish that quickly. Then on page 21, section 52 of the bill, lines 21.18 to 21.21, basically relates, this is again, I think this is transportation of live fish related to preventing the spread of an emergency fish disease, and again provides the commissioner with authority to prohibit that in the event that occurs on an expedited basis. And the order that would accomplish that is exempt from rulemaking requirements. On page 21, Section 54 at the bottom there authorizes the commissioner to issue an order that directs the use of or authorizes the use of game fish eggs as bait and prescribes restrictions. That order, as you can see at the top on page 22, would be exempt from rulemaking provisions. And then lastly, I think, on page 24, Section 58 provides some rulemaking authority that you can see spelled out there relating to game farm administration and directs the commissioner to amend the rules and provides a good cause exemption authority for that change.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Bonner. Senator Ingebrigtsen, real quick before we, just so I know where we're going with this, there was a question about the, has the fiscal note aspect been resolved? And I was told if it wasn't that we were notified that it should go back to finance. Have you? Section 26 of the bill has a small cost. Sorry, I probably should have. I just got note of this, so I'm.
Senator, Mr. Chair, Bob Meyer from the DNR here can make some comments with regards to that.
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, members of the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. Actually, the language in Section 26 that deals with the stamps allows us to adjust those stamps without coming back to the legislature. I believe it's a $3,800 savings in the reduction costs that we're identifying there.
$38,000
reduced revenue. Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. I have a different provision in my head. It reduces the revenue by $38,000, but what we're doing is actually adjusting this to reflect our actual costs of providing these stamps. So we're adjusting the revenue and accordingly to the revenue reductions we're able to absorb.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, didn't we do this in finance? Didn't we discuss this when you were there? Seems to me we had this discussion. But, Mr. Lundin, do you feel that this needs to go back to finance with that?
I did talk to the fiscal analyst, Dan Mueller, about this, and he did mention the issue that Mr. Myers has commented on. But I was just told also that finance wanted to look at it if this issue wasn't resolved. So.
So, Mr. Meyer, you're saying the costs are being absorbed here?
Mr. Chairman, members, the section that we're talking about begins on page 11, and the language that we're talking about changing begins on 11.18 under Section 26. Striking out $2, the current charge is, if you want a pictorial stamp mailed to you, is $2. That would cover the cost of producing and mailing the pictorial stamp. The change we're asking for allows us to adjust those fees in accordance with statute by written order published in the state register. Our intent is to reduce that payment from $2 to something less, which thereby has a negative reduction in the amount of money we're generating. And we are planning, our intent is to absorb those costs. Should the bill need to go to finance, we'd be fully supportive of that. We can have this discussion there as well, Mr. Chairman.
Whatever the wish of the chair.
Well, I think Senator Ingebrigtsen, what I'm hearing is that you can absorb this. So my feeling is it doesn't need to go back to finance. I mean, if it was the opposite, I'd say yes, but in this case, I don't believe it needs to. So, all right, Senator Ingebrigtsen, you may proceed.
That's the bill so far. I guess I'm going to open it up for questions if there are. Otherwise, I do have an amendment that I would like to offer if nobody has any other questions. It is the A8 amendment.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, you're offering an author's amendment?
I am. You're
not. On that amendment,
I still have to have somebody offer.
I'll offer it.
Oh, Senator Gazelka offers the A8 amendment to that, Senator Ingebrigtsen, while it's being passed out?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Knopf for his description of the amendment.
Mr. Chair, I'll just briefly go through the amendment. The first part of the amendment deletes two sections in the bill that were amending two subdivisions of a section dealing with crop depredation payments for crops damaged by elk. There is a provision being added to that allowing use of the money for fence damage. And so what this does is it replaces it with the entire section. So both of those two subdivisions still remain in here, but there are a couple of changes, there are also kind of references in the other subdivisions to make sure it's clear that it's consistent throughout. One change on 1.19 to 1.22 is the verification of fence damage by submitting photographs. So that's different from what's in the bill in front of you. Otherwise, that subdivision 3 is the same. And then again, the other subdivisions 2 and 4 are just to make it consistent throughout. The one that you should note is in your committee's purview is on. It starts on 2.22, and this deals with rules. Currently, the Department of Agriculture has the authority to adopt emergency rules, and there was no, as I understand it, when this was enacted in the 1980s, we had emergency rules in the statute. Now, this is a little bit different now. We don't really have emergency rules for all agencies. There are certain limited authorities for emergency rules. So what this would do is suggest to change that to expedited rules. So the commissioner may use the expedited rulemaking process, which is similar to what were emergency rules back in the 1980s. And then the other thing is to add in that they can do rules for compensation rates for fence damage. They already have rules on the crops that are damaged, but not on fences. So this adds a new clause 4 that allows them to promulgate rules for compensation rates on fence damage or destruction. And it also puts in some limits within that. So that's a section that clearly is in this committee's purview. And then there's a slight change on payments that are going to be made for stored silage and grain. That's a DNR program. It's their Emergency Deterrent Materials Assistance Program. There's a slight change in there on 2.33 to 2.34. And then there's a new section added to the bill starting on 2.36, dealing with it's a report from the Department of Natural Resources on shallow lakes management. So that's the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm curious about the addition of pasture, and I would like to ask Mr. Meyer to explain that, because it would seem to me that that is a significant change in terms of the volume that you might have to investigate in terms of compensation. Could you give us an idea of how much would it be added if you also have to compensate for damage to pasture and
Mr. Meyer?
Mr. Chair, Senator Torres-Ray, I think I'm going to ask that question be deferred to the Department of Agriculture. This is an issue we've been working with them jointly on, and it deals with the elk herd up in northwestern Minnesota and the damages that are occurring there. So if you don't mind, I would like to have either Geir Friso or Greta Gauthier answer that question.
Please state your name, and you may answer the question.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members, my name is Geir Friso, and I'm with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And as Mr. Meyer indicated, there is some areas of Minnesota that are impacted by elk, and it has been, in addition to crop, it has been some pastures, but they do tend to be very localized where that damage occurs. We typically do not expend all the money in the elk fund, so we do believe there will be sufficient funds available. And there is a cap of $20,000 per claimant.
Okay. Any further questions? Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Barley.
Senator Gazelka.
Are we on the amendment or the bill?
The amendment.
The amendment.
I move that we pass the amendment.
Senator Gazalka renews his motion to move the A8 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Amendment prevails. Any further discussion? Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, if we go back to page 11, the section that we were referring to earlier, lines 11, 18, it looks like we should probably pull out a few more words there. I might recommend that we look at only if the licensee pays an additional, no longer belongs in that sentence.
What line? 11 what?
Line 11, 18. Okay. We've taken out the $2 fee. Oh, the fee is still there.
Yes, still
the
be
fee is still there.
Fee.
My apology.
Thanks.
Okay. Any further questions? Senator Gazalka.
I move that Senate File 943 as amended be recommended to pass.
Senator Gazalka moves that Senate File 943 be recommended to pass as amended. All those in
I think this has to go to judiciary because it has a gross misdemeanor violation.
All right.
And refer to judiciary.
So Senator Gazalka moves Senate File 943 as amended to be recommended to pass and re-refer to judiciary. Any further questions? All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you,
Chair and members, thank you very much.
Senator Wolf, I believe, is next. Senate File 1146. Welcome back to the committee, Senator Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought I would start out with a recap of last Monday to refresh memories of what my bill is. The bill is a bill for having an opt-in for union members to opt into all the different extras that are included. I mentioned that we get three magazines. We get $10 to a crisis fund, $10 to a media fund, $10 to the political action committee, and $5 to I think it's teaching and learning foundation. So those are all extras that have nothing to do with the duties of the union when it comes to negotiations, arbitration, defending a teacher if need be, those kinds of roles of the union. And during the course of the discussion last Monday, Senator Cohen, I think, was thinking out loud and suggested that instead of doing an opt-in, perhaps we do an opt-out but include all of those, because currently you can opt out and get $15 worth back. You can opt out of two of those things if you know how to do it. And Senator Cohen suggested that maybe we make it so that you can opt out of all of them and just make sure that members are more aware of how that process works and how you can do it. And then the chair suggested that we meet and see if we can come up with anything for a way to improve this at all. And I did meet with Senator Cohen this morning, and I did tell him that my concern is that I want members to have control over those extras. I want them to be able to decide whether or not they want to pay for those extras. So whether we do according to my bill as an opt-in or as he suggested as the opt-out, if he wanted to make that a delete all amendment, I would consider it a friendly amendment. I'm guessing he's chosen not to do that since he's not here. But what I did say is that as far as how each of them would be implemented, with the opt-in, what it would simply consist of is the treasurer or whatever designee of the local executive board would simply present the members with some kind of a list of what all of our options are of the things that we can opt into, and members would just check off what they want to be a part of. And then the designee would send that to, for example, the school district, and they take care of all that anyway. In the opt-out, what that would do is once a year, members would have to send in a form I'm assuming it would just be an expansion of what currently is, send in a form to Education Minnesota, and then Education Minnesota would have to send out checks, refund checks, for all of those things that members want to opt out of. So my opinion was that it would be a lot more work for Education Minnesota if we did the opt-out versus if we did the opt-in and had the local units taking care of it. So with that in mind, I guess if there isn't going to be a proposal for a delete all, I would ask that somebody would re-recommend my bill.
I would so move that Senate File 1146 be recommended to pass.
Senator Olson moves that Senate File 1146 be recommended to pass.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Wigger.
I'd like to offer the A1 amendment.
Senator Wigger offers the A1 amendment.
I could explain as it's being.
Please do, Senator Wigger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this would further the idea that if a corporation organized under the laws of this state, authorized to do business, if they want to contribute to a foundation or to a political action committee or a publication, that it would be done only after a majority vote of the shareholders of the corporation have approved such a contribution.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Olson?
Mr. Chair, Senator Wigger, I'm trying to figure out what correlation that has to this bill and even the structure of it.
Mr.
Senator
Chair,
Wigger.
Senator Olson, it has to do with the option that if someone wants to be empowered on the use of money that's used for foundations or political action committees, publications as addressed in Senator Wolf's bill, that not only for a person that would be a union employee, but it would apply to corporations as well.
Mr. Chair?
Excuse me. Oh. Senator Wigger, I've just been informed in looking at this that this amendment would not fall under the jurisdiction of this committee according to Section 300.66. It would have to go through the Elections Committee.
Well,
Mr. Chair, I believe anything would be germane, and
you didn't challenge germane.
But in terms of the jurisdiction, then the proper motion, if it's adopted, then would be to have it re-referred to the committee with jurisdiction, which happens often. An example in the previous bill by Senator Ingebrigtsen.
And Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin?
Why wouldn't the one that Senator Wolf has here have to go through the Elections Committee if this one would? I don't see the difference there.
Mr. Bodden, would you help with the explanation?
Mr. Chairman, I think this chapter of law, Chapter 300, which the Senator Wigger's amendment would amend, is corporate law and would be under the jurisdiction of the Judiciary Committee. It's possible that, you know, because it refers to contributions to political action committees, that it might be re-referred to local government elections. Senator Wolf's bill deals with Chapter 179A, which is the Public Employee Labor Relations Act.
Senator Wolf?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was simply going to make the comment that, you know, if that's, you know, the route Senator Wigger wanted to go, I'm assuming that could be a separate bill. But how I see them different is I pay over $700 a year in union dues that are required for me to pay. I am not aware of any corporations that are required to pay back to their corporation. And so, I mean, like I said, that's a whole other can of worms. But I have $405 to Education Minnesota, $90 to my local, and $211 to the national. That's over $700 that I pay into union dues. That is not an option. To be a public school teacher in a school district, you have to do that. And so The only portion I'm talking about is those things that are extras that have nothing to do with the function of the union. And in today's, you know, technology, why I have to receive three magazines when, number one, they could put them online. Number two, I could save the paper. We're talking about the extras. We're not talking about union membership. We're just talking about the extras that members have to pay in addition to the regular dues.
Mr. Chair, I'd ask for a roll call.
Roll call has been asked for and granted. Senator Gazelka.
I'm just looking at the amendment, and I think in the end, if the shareholders did not like the direction the corporation was going, they would speak through their own ability to vote in a future time frame. So I'm not sure it's really necessary anyway. So I would oppose this amendment.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Senator Gazelka's comment, the same is true with the unions. If the members don't like the leadership and what they're doing with the money, they definitely have an ability to vote out their current leaders and vote other leaders in. So that that argument is kind of moot. But also, I'd like to ask Senator Wolf a question, Mr. Chair, if I may.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Senator Wolf, do you know how much money was given in contributions last election by corporations? And do you know how much of those contributions were known by the shareholders, or where they went, who, what party they were supporting, or how much just in Minnesota? Do you know how much money was spent last year?
Senator Wolf, maybe you could also, if we're going that route, then maybe you could list what the unions contributed as well, if you know.
Well, my first comment, Mr. Chair, was going to be, first of all, shareholders have an option of holding a share of the corporation. Union members do not have an option of being a union member. So that would be my first comment. So they do have some control there. I have no clue the numbers of either one.
All right, thank you. Senator Goodwin.
Senator Wolf, they have an option of being a fair share or full share member, which is definitely a difference in the amount of money that they spend to join the union. So they don't want to be a union member. They don't want to spend that much money. They can go down to a fair share member.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Wolf.
My options are I can pay 100% or I can pay 85%. My options are not zero. I have to pay no matter what.
Senator Dibble, did you have your hand up? Did I see
Senator Goodwin asked my question.
Okay, thank you. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious if Senator Goodwin was going to suggest maybe a bill for Minnesota to be a right-to-work state, then if we wanted to have this opportunity to opt out. I'll just throw that out there.
Any further discussion? Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer an amendment to the amendment.
Senator Lilly offers an amendment to the amendment, orally, I believe.
Yes, orally. Okay. I would like to recommend that in this amendment we strike the words in line 1.7, 1.8, every word after publication.
Mr. Bodern.
I'd like a roll call vote on
Mr.
that.
Mr. Chairman, that that amendment will work technically. Obviously, I'm not sure it's necessary to put additional law into statute that says that. I think they're already authorized to do that, but certainly is an amendment. That.
So there would be a period after the word publication? Is that how I understand this?
Yes.
And so everything after that would be stricken?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct, and I can restate it. On page 1 of the amendment, delete everything after publication, and on page 1, line 8, delete everything before the period.
Senator Dibble?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to request a roll call vote on the amendment to the amendment.
Has been granted twice. I did hear Senator Goodwin. I'd forgotten that she'd said that, so thank you.
And Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Dibble.
Thanks. I'd like to speak against the amendment to the amendment. Clearly, the effect of the amendment to the amendment, if it prevails, would be to simply negate the intent of the original offering by Senator Uyghur. It would be effectively a no vote on the A1. So, you know, I don't know why we can't have a vote on the substance of the A1, but I think an affirmative vote on the amendment to the amendment would be the equivalent to a no vote on the A1.
Further discussion? Senator Goodwin.
Oh, yeah, Mr. Chair. And Senator Lilly, seems to me that if this is the amendment that you want, then what you're saying is that it's not appropriate for shareholders to know where their money is going, but it is appropriate for union members to know where their money is going and have the option, but it's not appropriate for shareholders to be able to make that decision. We're not going to open up things so that shareholders know how corporations are spending their money, but we will open that up for. So there's a different, definitely a different standard here. So, Mr. Chair, this is to me quite obviously a very political action, I think it's very clear that what the purpose of this is that there's obviously some problem with thinking that perhaps Democrats are getting money out of union members more than Republicans are, or whatever the case may be, but. I think it's pretty obvious, and I worked for a union for 4 years, and I got to say I never heard members come to me with this kind of an issue and say, "Would you make sure we're not donating any money in our union to political candidates?" So my guess is that this is strictly an effort by Senator Wolf because she doesn't like her union dues to go to these functions, and therefore she's not. Wanting to get active in her own union to see that doesn't have to happen, but instead she's taken the easy way out here and trying to pass a law to prevent it from happening. So unfortunately, I think this is, forgive me for saying this, but a little bit self-serving.
Mr. Chair, being that amendment? Senator Wolf was name was brought up in that, would you like to respond before I go to Senator Gazelka and Thompson?
She wasn't addressing the amendment. We're on an amendment to the amendment right now.
But it was.
Correct.
And you're talking about the bill.
Correct. So. And thank you, Senator Olson, but I do want to give Senator Wolf a chance to respond if she would like to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I'm offended that you pretend to know my intentions. I don't pay to the political because regardless of where it goes, I don't think that that's the role of any I don't think they should be going anywhere. I do get my $10 back for the last 4 years because I figured out how to do it. For the first 20 years, I didn't know it was an option. The lack of the fact that you haven't heard from others does not indicate that it doesn't exist. We are talking, you jump straight to the political part of it, which does make it a political issue. We are talking $10 out of the 60 that I would like to see going back to the members.
Okay, and then we're going to proceed with Senator Gazelka, but before we do, let me remind you that we're not here to discuss what political motives one person has either way. We're here to discuss the merits of what's before. So, Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, my hope is that we, this amendment or amendment to the amendment, I'd rather it be withdrawn. The entire amendment shouldn't be an anti-union or an anti-business. If we take the author at the face value, they simply want union members who are union members to have options on the extras. She's not saying the union dues, the majority of them, not go to what they're supposed to go to, but the extras should be voted for or select that option. And I think we should take right at face value.
Senator Thompson.
I'll pass, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think likewise we should take the maker of the A1 amendment at his face value, and he simply wants transparency and disclosure for shareholders and where the proceeds and the treasury of the corporations which they own are going. And I'll just reiterate, Mr. Chair, that a vote for the Lilly Amendment is simply a vote to a vote against the A1 Amendment. That's the effect of that vote.
Any further discussion? Roll call has been asked for and granted. Secretary, take the roll on the amendment to the amendment.
Chairman Perry.
Yes.
Senator Carlson.
Yes.
Senator Cohen?
No.
Senator Dibble?
No.
Senator Gazelka?
Yes.
Senator Goodwin?
No.
Senator Lilly?
Yes.
Senator Olson?
Yes.
Senator Ortman?
Yes.
Senator Thompson?
Yes.
Senator Torres-Ray?
No.
Senator Wieger?
No.
On a vote of 7 yeses, 5 noes, the amendment prevails. The amendment to the amendment. Any further discussion on the A1 amendment? Roll call has been requested and granted. Secretary?
Well, Ms. I've got a comment.
Senator Goodwin?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to lay this amendment over since it doesn't do what Senator Wieger at all, what Senator Wieger was hoping to do. It's an entirely different issue, so I would like to a roll call vote on that.
Mr. Chair, if I have the option
Senator
to
Wieger.
Withdraw the amendment.
Yes.
You do?
I would withdraw the amendment.
Senator Wieger withdraws the A1 amendment. I have a list of testifiers, and I will call the names. And if you're here, we'll hear testimony. If not, we'll continue to move on. I have a testifier from the AFL-CIO, the legislative director. I think it's Jennifer Schaubach. Is that correct? Is she here? Okay. I believe Mr. Rice is here from the Police Officers Federation of Minneapolis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Brian Rice, representing the Police Officers Federation of Minneapolis. Lieutenant John DeMonaco could not be here today. He asked me to testify on his behalf. The Police Officers Federation of Minneapolis represents over 900 police officers. It's the largest police union in the state. We're here today to oppose Senator Wolf's Senate File 1146. The Police Federation was one of the first unions formed in the state after collective bargaining of public employees was allowed in 1971. And prior to that time, they had an organization that represented their members' interest. And that history goes back to the 1930s. It was a professional or a union of sorts. And all of the dues that the members paid have been voted on by their individual members, to including political expenditures and including a fund that provides $2 every time a police officer dies. All the other members of the organization, including after they're retired, contribute $2 to help defray funeral expenses. We think that it's worked. We don't see the need for this legislation. We believe that members have the right to enter into agreements amongst each other privately, and part of that group dynamic allows members to have deductions for various things. The legislature has recognized that for a long time. You do it not only with unions, you do it under just a general freedom of contract that people can make arrangements amongst each other, and the legislature doesn't go in and interfere with that agreement. That principle is, in fact, enshrined in our state and federal constitutions where you allow freedom of contract, and we would genuinely submit there's no need for the legislature to step in and regulate this matter, and we oppose the bill for that reason.
Thank you. We have Mr. Thornburg. And please register, if you would, please. Any testifiers? Thank you, Mr. Thornburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Thornburg. I'm president of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters Association. I'm here to speak against the bill. Having been a local president for the IAFF in Minneapolis for 9 years and been the state president now for 4, we have a democratic process at the union level. The members can come to union meetings. They can make motions. They can submit bylaw changes. They can change anything of what the union dues go for. This is a process not unlike this process. When I run my meetings, it's very similar to this. Their motions are made. Bylaw changes are submitted. The members have control of the money already. I don't see that it's necessary for the legislature to get involved in another democratic process. I don't think it's necessary, and I strongly oppose this.
Thank you. Mr. Michaels? Is there a Mr. Michaels?
He is not here, Mr. Chairman.
All right, thank you, Mr. Rice. James Hager? Please state your name, and you may proceed.
Good afternoon, and thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is James Hager. I'm here with Education Minnesota. I'd like to testify in opposition to the bill. Education Minnesota opposes this bill for two reasons. First, this proposal is onerous and unnecessary, and it would simply add a layer of bureaucracy and inefficiency to a system that already works for our members and already allows members that don't want to be involved to decline to donate to our PAC and to our foundation. Since Education Minnesota's founding, our members have supported and approved of this system. If they'd like to see a change in the system, they have a chance to say so at our convention each and every year. To this point, no proposal to ever change the system has been made at our convention. When members join the union, individual members, they have an opportunity to decline to donate to the PAC and to the foundation, and individual members are sent automatically a refund request form each year. The second reason that we oppose the bill is it would further tilt our electoral system towards big business and hurt the middle class. This bill intends to weaken workers' voices in the political process. This bill would make it more difficult for members to spend $10 each to collectively fight for their own interests, and it would eliminate an important check on big businesses. Given the increase in corporate power from the Citizens United decision, it's very important that middle-class working people have a strong voice in elections and in politics, and this bill would seek to stifle that voice. In closing, the current system works for our members, and this bill is an unnecessary solution in search of a problem. This proposal would stifle workers' voices in the political process, and for that reason, we oppose the bill. Happy to answer any questions that the committee has. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Hager. Senator Thompson?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I apologize, sir. I didn't get your last name jotted down.
Hager, H-A-G-G-A-R.
Mr. Hager, isn't it true that there's only going to be an issue with money coming in, and therefore, as you characterize it, stifling someone's voice if people don't want to send their money? If they're supportive of what the organization is doing, there'll be no problem, right?
Mr. Hager?
Mr. Chair, members, you know, the change in the system would be very bureaucratic and very onerous. It'd be a very onerous change. You'd be looking at, instead of a system right now in which districts automatically deduct money and members who would like to receive a refund do so pretty easily. You'd have a lot of additional paperwork, a lot of additional issues in terms of what is deducted from whom and when, and that would collectively take a lot of time, a lot of resources, and be very inefficient, both at the school district level and at the union level.
Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just by way of follow-up, my question didn't go to the issue of the cost or the bureaucracy involved. My question went to your point that presumably this would quiet voices because you wouldn't get as much money, but that's only true if the members of the union choose not to pay that money because they don't like what the union is doing, correct?
Mr. Hager.
Mr. Chairman and members, it is true that this proposal would only have an impact depending on what members chose to do. That's already the current system, though. If members don't want to donate to the PAC or to the foundation, they already have that option, so that's already very possible within the current system.
Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hager. But still, the end result is if members like what the union is doing and want their money to be spent that way, this would have no impact upon the amount of money coming in, correct?
Mr. Hager.
Mr. Chairman and members, this would have an impact on the operation of the union. It would have an impact on the ability of the union to use those resources on behalf of the members. So I would say that it would have an impact.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, to Mr. Hagar's point, I don't know why we're getting in and micromanaging and meddling in the internal administrative process of what is effectively and essentially a private organization. You know, they've figured out a method and a means by which they can give their their members a free and clear choice, and they proactively send them the forms that they need to opt out of this particular expenditure. Why are we sitting in this committee trying to micromanage the internal affairs of what is essentially a private entity? People who can manage their, they're all grown-ups. They're all professionals. They can manage their time and their paperwork and their money as best they see fit. So why are we doing this? We have no business in here.
Well, I guess from testimony that I've heard both from the author, is that it took 20 years for someone to understand how they could opt out and when they understood that. So in my mind, it's apparent that this particular organization has not maybe done due diligence to notify as well as they should have, and that's probably what brought this forth, but I'll let the author answer that.
Chair, I still ask, so why is that our business anyways? Why can't the members then deal with their leadership and raise a little heck and say, make it more clear, I didn't understand for 20 years how I could do this? Why are we sitting here in this committee as a committee of the state legislature spending time on this little bit of picky business internal to an organization that's not our organization?
Mr. Chair?
Go ahead. Well, I believe one thing here is one reason it's here is because the dues checkoff is in law. So it would come here, but Senator Wolf wanted to respond.
Yeah, I wanted to respond to a comment that both Mr. Haggard and Senator Dibble made. Senator Dibble, you mentioned that the forms are being sent, and you mentioned that that members are being sent a refund request. I would like you to explain how a member gets that $10 and $5 back.
Mr. Haggard.
Mr. Chairman and members and Senator, when a member signs up for to join Education Minnesota, they are informed of the request for $10 for the PAC and $5 for the foundation. They're also informed of the process that they can go through in which to get a refund on that. Each additional year that a member is part of the union, they receive in the mail with the educator newsletter automatically a refund request form. And so that comes to them each and every year. And I would just state again that this is something that has not ever come before our convention in terms of something that members are upset about or would like to see a change in. And we have not heard from the membership that this is an issue as it stands.
Senator Wolf.
Yes, thank you. I want to bring up that form comes in one of the pages of one of the magazines that we receive. And when you get it, you have to send the original, and it has to be postmarked by October 31st, or you do not get your refund. And as far as never heard, I will challenge that because I sat in a meeting at the headquarters with Ms. Alzweiger and heard 30 teachers complain about this process. So it has been brought to the attention of Education Minnesota.
All right, thank you. Next testifier is Julie excuse me, Senator Ortman.
Thank you. Senator Wolf, thank you for bringing your bill. My concern is about free speech, rights of free speech, and Senator Dibble thinks this is a little matter, but I think it's a very big matter. And I think what you're getting at is that the dollars are being used in furtherance of speech that members might not agree with, and that they have to go back after the fact to disagree, but the money's already been spent. And I think that's a very big matter, Senator Dibble. That's not a picky matter. If folks feel like their rights of free speech are being exercised on their behalf before they have a right to ask for a refund, I can imagine that they have some concerns about that. And I would agree with Senator Wolf that we should do everything in our power to make sure that that doesn't happen, that they know in advance before that speech actually occurs, assumably on their behalf.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I have a
Senator, Senator Dibble, and then we'll go to Torres Ray.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, I apologize if I wasn't clear. I think free speech is a very important matter. I think what we have no business in is dictating the administrative details of how this particular matter gets carried out internal to an organization that doesn't receive its charter authorization from us. It's a union. It's their organization and something for them to tend to. And there is a provision for allowing folks to not have their own money used for that purpose, and that's communicated to them. So are getting in, what I think is a picky matters, are getting in and micromanaging their processes internal to their own organization. Free speech is very important. And so I object to, you know, my characterization of that issue as Senator Ortman did. But I do think we have no business messing around in this particular administrative function on behalf of any labor union.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
We're going to go to, I'm going to, Senator Wolf, Torres Ray, and Olson. So Senator Wolf.
Just to that point, I would agree with you, which is also why I would love to see the state legislator not put a statute in that says that the school district can take the money straight out of my paycheck. That is mandated by the state, allowing the unions to do that. So if we're going to go down that road, then let's be consistent. They are already involved.
Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question for the author. Senator Wolf, it seems that we have representatives from these different groups that represent thousands of people. And I would assume this is a public hearing that they speak on behalf of these individuals, thousands of teachers, firefighters, police officers, and they said that this is something that they really don't think is necessary, that they oppose this. You've come before us to say that this is necessary and that you have heard from these same individuals that this needs to be done, but you've brought absolutely no one to testify on your behalf. And I find it difficult for me, you know, I don't want to accuse you of self-serving, really, but I think that it is important to recognize that these individuals are in a public hearing representing the voices of thousands. And somehow you're saying that these individuals are actually giving us inaccurate information, because you have accurate information from people from these same groups that believe that what you're doing is necessary. Do you have anyone who can come and testify?
I would, before I let you answer, Senator Wolf, I seem to have heard Senator Wolf say that she was at a meeting with Education Minnesota where 30 specific union dues paying members had the same concern. Right. Is that correct, mm-hmm. Senator Wolf?
That's my point, Mr. Chair. I would like to see you bring in those voices, because I think it makes it very difficult for me, at least, you know, to hear all of these representatives. They come here to represent their voice, and you are here with us. You're one of our members, and say, you know, this needs to be addressed. But yet you have no one person testifying with you to move this forward.
Senator
Mr. Chair,
Wolf.
I would love to address that. Senator Torres Ray, the people that I represent are all at work. The people who are here speaking on behalf of the union members are paid lobbyists who are here to talk to you. I'd be happy to give you emails and other correspondence that I've had with people. You could call Ms. Alzwager and get the name of all those teachers from throughout the state who came, and from all over the state who came to this meeting to express their concerns with this issue as well as several other issues. But I don't have anybody. The other advantage that Education Minnesota has is if they want a teacher to come testify, they can pay for a sub for them. If I have a teacher come testify, they have to take a day off that they pay for.
Senator Olson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Wolf addressed part of it, that as far as our engagement, we've already are requiring that the school districts who we fund collect the dues for this organization. And I shouldn't ask if I don't already know the answer, but can you tell me if the convention days for your organization are paid days? Are we paying for the teacher's salary for those two convention days, or are they on your own?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I'm assuming the convention that's being referred to are the 2 days in October. If there are other days, I'm not aware of them. And it would be interesting to know the percentage of teachers that actually show up for that. It's a series of workshops and whatnot. Most of the teachers in the five buildings that I have taught in consider those to be 2 days to have a vacation, spend a long weekend with their family, and do miscellaneous other things. And so they are incorporated into our schedule.
So, Mr. Chairman, those are paid days for teachers.
They're maybe I'm assuming it's spread out throughout our salary, but it's 2 days that we don't have school.
All right, we're going to move on with more testimony. Thank you, Mr. Hager. Miss, I want to say it right. Is it Blyle?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee and Senator Perry. My name is Julie Blyle.
Blyle, that's what I thought. Thank you.
It's a difficult name to spell. I am the legislative director for AFSCME Council 5, representing 42,000 state, county, municipal employees throughout the state of Minnesota. We are here today in opposition to Senator Wolf's bill. I think the gentleman from Education Minnesota outlined the process very well. This is unnecessary. It's duplication as far as bureaucracy. We have employers at the state, county, and local levels. All of those employers have the process in place, as well as the employees know what the process is. Our organization is run with a small d. When we refer to the convention, we have our members that attend their local meetings, and they have to solicit support from their fellow members to be elected a delegate to the convention. That's a very, very active process, very competitive. Our convention is held, policies are debated. This issue has not come forward in the form of a resolution or a motion from the floor. I think it is an answer in search of a problem. And I want to state that the only place I've really seen this issue surface is on the agenda for the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is a conservative organization who has proposed to legislators in states to bring forward this piece of legislation. It's in a laundry list of other legislative proposals that attack public employees, whether that be to eliminate their collective bargaining rights, whether that be to change their health care, whether that be to take away their defined benefit and switch to defined contribution. So at this point, I would like to say that legislators, to urge them to vote against this, to defeat this, and to allow public employees to have a voice in the workplace and here at the legislature. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Blyle, how is giving someone the opportunity to choose to spend or not to spend their money an attack on an employee? How is that an attack?
Ms. Blyle.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Thompson, what I was referring to when I said attacks on public employees, the individual pieces of legislation that the American Legislative Exchange Council has proposed, if you look at the pieces of legislation that they have brought forward to the states, and if you do a search on the web, you'll find those pieces of legislation have been introduced in various states. And you'll find what they do to public employees by taking away their right to negotiate health care, by mandating health care savings accounts, by taking away their defined benefit, by actually proposing to take away their rights to collectively bargain. That's what that agenda is, and this proposal, only that proposal that they have even goes further. It eliminates the right for the deduction, and that's a proposal that is on their agenda.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Russ Stanton. Please remember to sign the sign-in sheet. State your name and you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Russ Stanton. I am Director of Government Relations for the Interfaculty Organization. The Interfaculty Organization is the union for the faculty at the seven state universities. I'm here to testify in opposition to the bill, first on the grounds that it's not necessary in order to protect the rights of members, and secondly, that it's administratively burdensome. And you know, the one thing that impresses me as I listen to discussions is that people often don't know how unionization works and representation works. And so I had passed out a copy of the section of PELRA that's the full section of PELRA that's being amended. And Just to point out, for instance, that you do not have to join the union, et cetera, and I'll refer to that. First of all, you should understand that there's a difference between a bargaining unit and a union. The state workforce is divided up into 17 bargaining units by law, and it's up to those bargaining units whether they organize into a union or not. They have to petition to have an election, and a union has to win the election in order for those people to be unionized. But so IFO, for instance, won the right to represent the state university faculty. But even though we won that election, doesn't mean that all the faculty have to join the union. It's totally voluntary on the part of each individual faculty member whether they join the union or don't join the union. In our case, 84% of the people join the union and 16% do not join the union. We do not charge union dues to people that don't join the union. But we are bound by law to fairly represent them, to negotiate on their behalf, just like for members. They enjoy all the benefits of the contracts that we negotiate, and we have the same duty to represent them in the case of a grievance for dismissal or discipline or whatever that we do any other member. And so we are allowed, if you look on page 2 of the law, we are allowed to charge non-members a fair share fee to cover the cost of negotiating the contract and enforcing the contract. But we are not allowed to charge non-members, people who didn't voluntarily join the union, we are not allowed to charge them for political contributions. We're not allowed to charge them for donations that we as a union make to the Penny Fellowship or the Nellie Stone Johnson Scholarship Fund or whatever. That is not charged to a non-member. As a matter of fact, even my salary here representing the union members for on issues like opposing cuts in pay or opposing increases in health care premiums or opposing increases in contributions to pension plans, even though those benefit the fair share members, they don't get charged for my time, or they don't even get charged for my secretary's time for doing that because they can only be charged for the cost of negotiating the contract and enforcing the contract. And so, it's very simple for people who do not want to join the union, do not like who we contribute money to for political campaigns, or who don't like the fact that we contribute to the Nellie Stone Johnson Scholarship, or who don't like the fact that we oppose constitutional amendment on marriage, whatever, they have a very simple option available to them. They just don't join the union. And if they don't join the union, no money is collected for those activities, and, they have their way. They still enjoy the benefits of collective bargaining, and they're paying for that part, but they're not paying for the rest. And so I think we do have a system in place that fairly treats those people. It's been held up in court on constitutional grounds. I find it somewhat confusing how actually this would be enforced. For instance, if we got a request from the student organization, which sponsors the Nellie Stone Johnson Scholarship Fund, if we got a request to buy a table for $800, do we have to go around to all of our 4,000 members and get them to sign a card to contribute to that? I mean, it becomes kind of administratively ridiculous to try to do that. I think the system we have in place right now works just fine. If you don't like what we're doing, don't be a member. Like what we're doing, you get the whole package.
Thank you, Mr. Stanton.
Thank you.
Mr. Tuberin?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Matt Tuberin. I represent SEIU Local 284, Union of Public School Support Staff, and also speak on behalf of MSEA, the Minnesota School Employees Association. Not to belabor your time, want to echo a lot of the comments of the previous testifiers. Our members oppose this bill because of the unnecessary nature and the opening up a legal Pandora's box into the internal organizational policy of an independent organization. And I just want to say, since we are speaking about members' dues, that we take the highest responsibility and level of fiduciary responsibility to the use of our members' dues, and it's something that we take very, very seriously. And to that end, our member-led organization, where the members make the decisions and they elect leaders, they vote on our annual budget. All unions are not the same. We're not one monolithic group. We're all very different, and we're all very different because a union at its core is a group of employees who came together and voted on a democratic process by a majority to form a collective, to form as a union for the purposes of collectively bargaining with their employer. And because of that, they each have their own internal policies and procedures. And so many of the things that, when we look at this specifically proposed bill that has specific issues to deal with Education Minnesota, doesn't really, we have a very difficult time trying to figure out how that would affect our operations. We have a board of members that are elected by the membership. They create our budget, our annual budget, along with the executive director. Every member has an opportunity annually to vote on that budget. We have a membership and dues committee where any member with any issue about their membership or dues can come to that committee and work on that issue, and we have issues go through that committee all the time that are then brought forward to the membership to constantly improve that process. A lot of the confusion that we have is that, along with the donations, we have recently the bus drivers in Edina School District did a food drive where students on their buses collected food. They collected over 7,000 pounds of food, and the bus drivers collected money amongst themselves for a donation to go with this food to Sharing and Caring Hands. And the board of our elected board of our union decided that they wanted to have a matching grant to encourage our members of these bus drivers that if they could raise a certain amount, that we would match them to do that. And that was a decision made by the board to do that, and so we were able to donate a few thousand dollars to Sharing and Caring Hands along with food. Now, if this bill were to pass, would we then have to go to every one of our 8,000 members to have them check off a separate card to say that, yes, our board can make these donations? And then the only other point I would make is reiterate the previous testifier that a fair share member, that for 85% the full cost of representation and bargaining, you don't have to be a member. And so your dues aren't used on anything else. And if you are a member, then you have full voice and full say on how that extra 15% is used. So with that, Mr. Chair and members, I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Senator Wolf, would you explain one last time exactly what your bill is intended to do?
The bill is intended, thank you, sorry, Mr. Chair, is intended to simply allow members to decide what to do with the dues that are being collected to pay for the extras, such as magazines, foundations, various funds. What I've heard from the six lobbyists who testified is that it's not necessary. The perception that it's not necessary does not mean that it's going to be harmful in any way, first of all, if we do it. Secondly, I don't even know where to start with some of the membership things that were brought up, which is not what we are addressing. I don't think it's good policy to say that you pay 100% or you pay 85% if you don't want the extras. So you have to give up your membership if you don't want to pay for the extras, versus having the option of paying for the extras and still being allowed to be a member. Like I said, when I originally started this last Monday, it's not an anti-union bill. The one testifier went off on all these other things, had nothing to do with this bill. And it's a pro-union member bill.
Thank you. Senator Gazelka.
Will the Senate file 1146 be recommended to pass, Mr. Chair?
Senator Gazelka
roll call.
Moves Senate file 1146 be recommended to pass. A roll call has been requested and granted. Secretary, take the roll.
Yep.
Senator Olson.
Well, I just want to express my support for the work of Senator Wolf, and frankly, all the testifiers have just raised more questions and concerns than they've settled them. Even reading this, how does it happen that we've said in no event may the fair share fee exceed 85% of the regular membership dues? Does that mean that the activities kind of expand to fill that maximum? That all 85%, who decided that 85% is what is needed for carrying out the collective bargaining agreement? I think it's grossly unfair to individuals who are members, and as to the bureaucracy, if you have the dollar amounts, if you've got the budgets that you talk about, that how much is a part of your budget for foundations, whether it's wherever you're going to give the money to, or for these funds, and they check out that they don't want it, subtract it from their dues, and turn it in to whoever's is collecting it at the district level and so on. That's not even math, it's arithmetic. So there's just nothing wrong with your bill, Senator Wolf.
Secretary, take the roll.
Chairman Perry?
Yes.
Senator Carlson?
Yes.
Senator Cohen?
No.
Senator Dibble?
No.
Senator Gazelka?
Yes.
Senator Goodwin?
No.
Senator Lilly?
Yes.
Senator Olson?
Yes.
Senator Ortman?
Yes.
Senator Torres, right?
No.
Senator Weaker?
No.
Being there's six yeses and five noes, motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Wolf. We're going to move right along with Senator Senjum, Senate File 994. It's being handed out to you members right now. It did not get into your packet. Welcome, Senator Senjum.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members. To move this along, I have an A11 amendment. If somebody could enter it.
Senator Ortman moves the A11 amendment.
And Mr. Chair, to that amendment, Senate Counsel had a slight oral verbiage change that would bring it into further order. Perhaps he can offer it.
Mr. Bodden?
So, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Ortman could incorporate this in the amendment. This is just conforming language. On page 1, line 34 of the amendment, delete A and insert the required. And then on page 1, line 35 of the amendment, delete of 30%. So the second sentence would read, the organization must increase its rating to the required minimum or be subject to sanctions. And that way it picks up either the 30 or 20% referred to in lines 31 and 32.
No, what are you talking about? Where's the amendment?
On the A11 amendment, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Amendment prevails. Senator Sanchez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll try to be brief and to the point. This bill, as amended, involves the subject of bingo. And last fall I had occasion, there was a charitable gaming convention in Rochester. I met with, I believe, with five or six of the people that run bingo halls around Minnesota for charitable causes. In my case, in the city of Rochester, the Senior Citizens Center runs a bingo hall to support financially the activities of that organization. It's well run by good people and does great things for our community. Problem is, in many of these bingo halls, they're not able to, if you will, meet the formula in terms of the money given back to the charitable cause. Again, in my case, the Senior Citizens Center. This bill basically, if you look through the verbiage here, you'll see, you know, various levels of charitable expenditures back to the cause, which give you some sort of a rating. Now, at the bottom of the hill at this point is a 30% back to the charity. In my case in Rochester and in several other bingo cases, bingo hall cases where they just do exclusively bingo. Trying to meet that threshold, given the expenses that bingo halls have just in terms of their normal operation, whether it's big parking lots that need snow plows or heat or light or staff or whatever it might be, that 30% we found is difficult to meet. And so this, Mr. Chair and members, simply suggests that that 30% be reduced to 20%, and that's the essence of the change. And why don't I will, if I may, Ms. Chair, just call on Ms. Deb Nussbaum of Rochester, who runs the Senior Citizens Bingo Activity Program in our city.
Ms. Nussbaum, please state your name for the record.
My name is Deb Nussbaum. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you. I prepared some remarks. I hope that's okay. I have worked and lived in Rochester for the last 27 years. And after giving my time to the corporate world, working in Rochester for 27 years, I decided at the end of 2009 to quit that job and dedicate my time to the nonprofit world. I've been giving that time to the Senior Center for the last 16 months, and I come to you today as their board president to ask for your help. Nonprofits in the state are struggling. We have so many things that are changing in the economy. Donations are down. And aid from organizations like the United Way, federal and state sources, have also been changing. We got involved in charitable gambling in 2007 as a way to help get some consistency in funding sources and to reduce our dependence on aid from governmental sources. Our charity runs Flamingo Bingo in Rochester. It is a bingo hall, and we don't run anything else. It is strictly bingo. So we run a facility that has bingo operations every day of the week except for one day. We raise money. Our whole purpose is to raise money to give to this charity, nothing else. We follow the Minnesota state statute that we're discussing today, and it includes requirements that we must meet in order to maintain our operation. If we don't meet those requirements, we could be subject to fines, probation, and at the worst case, be asked to close. The statute, as Senator Senjum outlines, requires that we provide 30% of our gross receipts. So gross receipts would be all the sales that we take in minus prizes paid. So 30% of that money must be given to the charity and to state taxes. It is there for good reason. I'm not here to debate its value. I think it's a good thing. I think it's a good requirement that we need to continue to maintain. But what I'm here to talk about is it's an unachievable mark for operations like ours that are strictly bingo halls. It was really designed around a bar operation. Pull tabs and bar bingo operate out of a bar operation. They do not have the same kind of overhead that bingo halls have in terms of rent, utilities, and payroll, and maintaining the parking lot, as was mentioned. Flamingo Bingo is one of eight bingo halls that still exist in the state of Minnesota. They're dying off because of the difficulty it is to continue to maintain those. And what happens along the way then is the charities that are benefiting from those are losing out on those funds. I want so much more money to go to the charity, and so much more that I've made it my life's work over the last 16 months to get every dime possible out of Flamingo Bingo back to the charity. I've donated over 2,700 hours to make that happen. We've completely changed our financial structure. We've reduced our prize payouts. We've reduced salary to our employees. They're very dedicated people who want to get money to the charity as well. We've negotiated a $4 per square foot lease rate on our building and continue to reduce absolutely every expense that we can. Yet we're still not able to make that 30% mark. We successfully have given $70,000 to the charity this year, and we've paid nearly $50,000 in state taxes, yet we're still not making that 30% mark. I'm here to ask you to allow us to continue this kind of operation. If you allow this change to 20%, we will be able to make that 20% mark. We will be able to continue to give money to the charity, pay our taxes, and keep this a viable business in Rochester and the other bingo halls in the state. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions of the testifier, Senator Olson?
No, I didn't have any questions. I just wanted to move the bill.
Senator Olson, proceed.
I move that Senate File 994, as amended, be recommended to pass.
Senator Olson moves that Senate File 994, as amended, be recommended to pass. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Chair and members, thank you very much.
We're going to move on to Senator Cruz, who has been waiting patiently in the back there. Senate File 1234, or for some of you, 1234. There was no reason that I looked over at you. I just did, Senator. It's the tie. Between you and Senator Carlson over there, well, and even Lily, the ties are quite interesting today. A little levity here while we bring you up, Senator Cruz. Please proceed.
Levity is always great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, committee members. I appreciate the opportunity to be before you today. Today we have basically the Secretary of State's business housekeeping bill. So a lot of pretty technical stuff that I have a fantastic testifier here, Bert Black, that he will be able to explain in much better detail than I would ever be able to. But if it would please the chairman, I do have a couple of housekeeping issues first. If I could have somebody move the A1 amendment for me, it's an author's amendment to kind of get the bill in the shape we would like it.
Senator Olson moves the A1 amendment. It's in your folders. Proceed, Senator Cruz. Oh, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All the same side. Prevails.
Excellent. One other quick thing. You do have kind of a brief summary in there about the exact provisions of the bill. Just wanted to make a quick comment about the first two bullet points that are under the bill provides for. Those numbers for the sections at the end of each of those bullet points need to be switched. So we just kind of transpose those accidentally. And then last, if it should be the committee's will to pass this on, which I hope it would, if you could please do that to Judiciary. Chairman Limmer has asked to see this bill as well.
Okay, thank you.
And with that, I will let Mr. Black take it away.
Please state your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Bert Black. I am an attorney with the Secretary of State's office, and I've been there since 1981. And so we've had a lot of technical bills over that time. This is our business services housekeeping bill this year, and it covers a number of technical issues. The thing that we're really trying to do with this bill, which is generated from our staff within the agency, within the office, as they go through the various laws that we administer for businesses, business corporations, limited liability companies, limited partnerships, and the like. And we have about 8 or 9 business types that have different laws here in Minnesota. And so we're constantly looking to try and make these more consistent with each other here in Minnesota. And so we have a number of these bullet points here, boil it down. We have a number of sections that deal with business trusts, which are a kind of business filing. We don't get very many of them. We get about 15 of them a year. Okay. And also municipal power and gas agencies. We have a total of 7 of those in the state. And this provides for a streamlined method of filing with our office and eliminates the need for issuing a certificate to them. The next group of sections, as Senator Cruz pointed out, the numbers are flip-flopped on these two, deal with certificates. We do about probably 100 certificates of various kinds, a certificate of organization or incorporation, a certificate of merger, various corporate transactions. We have a few of them that require the actual time of the transaction. Only a few. The others don't require it. There's no reason for the time to be in the law on the certificate. That is something which you can get from the document itself. The time is recorded with respect to that document. Similarly, in the last couple of sessions, we've been able to have authorized the use of email, but there are still a number of sections in the law that refer specifically to the U.S. mail. And so we are going through in this bill and cleaning those particular sections up so that notices can be provided by other than United States mail, especially since postage appears to continually go up. We have a couple of very oddball situations. If you look down at the fourth bullet point, almost every non-Minnesota business type can use an alternate name in Minnesota if they register that name with our office. That's been something that's been in the law for many, many years, particularly for foreign corporations. For some reason, the law right now doesn't allow non-Minnesota limited liability partnerships to do that. We're just trying to eliminate that rule, which nobody else has to obey. And there's no particular policy reason for that. It's just an oversight in the law. Similarly, the limited liability partnership law, if they have to maintain a registered agent, this will conform that law to allow for revocation if they don't maintain that agent. All the other business types are under that rule right now already. There are three sections that deal with the extension of duration of an entity. Many years ago, 80 years ago, you couldn't have a corporate entity that had more than 30 years duration. Obviously, that has changed. Right now, the rule is everybody has perpetual duration unless you affirmatively choose otherwise in your documents. We have not had an extension of an entity after duration in the last 6 years. It appears that there's no reason to retain this in the law. And finally, we do have section 2 and 3, which relate to something which I'd like to explain at a little greater detail, if I might. And they relate to the use of certain data in the Social Security number or tax identification number in a UCC filing. Let me explain. The Uniform Commercial Code is a set of uniform state laws designed to ease commercial transactions by setting up standard rules for commercial transactions so that each of those transactions already has some set rules and not everything needs to be individually negotiated. It's been passed in all the states. Minnesota's had it since 1967. These documents, particularly Article 9, provide a record of collateral in secured financing. That is to say, you borrow against a piece of equipment, you list the piece of equipment on record in our files. You make a filing. These records are then searched by banks and other lenders when a borrower wants to put collateral up to make sure that the particular collateral hasn't already been spoken for. We do a lot of these. We file over 118,000 UCC filings last year. We also produce 90,000 searches each year of these records. The searches include the data in terms of what filings are out there, and they often include copies of the actual filings. You really, if you're doing a proper search as a lender, you really should take a look at the specific copies to see exactly which collateral has been spoken for. We are trying to fully automate this process, both for the benefit of 24/7 availability to both lenders and borrowers, and to reduce human intervention in the filing and searching process, and therefore to reduce staff costs. UCC documents, we do not ask in the form for Social Security numbers. However, they are sometimes provided mostly by users who are what we call bogus filers. Bogus filers are individuals who have no legitimate financial transaction, but they file either what we call a harassment or a straw man filing. The harassment filings are, well, they're just that. They are filed against someone the individual has a grudge against. In the recent past, these have included Governor Pawlenty, his spouse, who was then a judge in Dakota County, legislators, judges, court administrators, and others, mostly in law enforcement. Those are the harassment filings. You could also file it just against your neighbor if you have a beef with your neighbor. There's no legitimate reason for those. However, the Social Security problem comes up in the other kind, the straw man filings. These are called straw man filings because the individuals who do these filings file against themselves, and they attach all sorts of documents to the filing, including copies of their driver license, their birth certificate, and their Social Security card. And this last document is the problem because, of course, now it's in the record and the SSN is private data. Now, we don't get very many of these unwanted SSNs. Remember, I said we do about 118,000 or more filings each year. We get a couple of hundred or so of these bogus filings with SSNs each year, so a very small percentage. However, if we have this data in our records and then we release it in the copies that lenders ask for or anybody else asks for, you know, there are possible penalties for the release of private data. Now, we've looked in the marketplace, and we have not found a good, effective software that redacts the SSN, and only the SSN. The problem with the software out there is it focuses on number strings. Unfortunately, when you're doing collateral, when you're entering collateral on a UCC, there are a lot of serial numbers and other numerical pieces of data connected with the particular pieces of personal property that are set up as the collateral. For example, the serial number on a John Deere tractor. If you're taking a loan, maybe you have an agricultural loan, and you're going to pledge the tractor as the collateral. Well, that's got numbers on it too. The software doesn't effectively differentiate that. The problem then is that we have to resort to manual review. This is really an unsustainable model at this point. So the language that you have in Section 2 before you, which is on page 1 and over to page 2 of the bill, this is an approach that we've worked out with the Information Policy Analysis Division of the Department of Administration, which is the office that recommends data policy. We discussed a number of different approaches with them, and what they suggested is that, especially for the online filings, which are subject to the terms and conditions of use on our website, the approach would be that if a person who is asking for the copy, and these are generally commercial search firms or banks, if they agree to our terms and conditions of use, and that also can be extended to the paper requests that we get. We do get a paper request for these official UCC searches. That if they agree to the terms and conditions of use, and that if the terms and conditions of use have the language in them in lines 2.6 to 2.9, which will restrict the person receiving the copy from sharing the Social Security information or using it for any purpose not required by law, IPAD has determined that that will allow us to provide the information, the copies of the UCC documents, without liability. And so we're simply trying to avoid holding up, really, the commercial lending process in the state of Minnesota, because we have generally these bogus filers who really are creating havoc. The legislature has already, about 5 years ago, in 2006, passed laws against these bogus filers, but many of them continue to file, and so we're simply trying to make it possible to provide commercial loans at less of a risk and more quickly. Otherwise, we're going to have to start looking through each of these documents manually, which, of course, defeats the purpose of the automation. And I'm sorry for taking so long, but there's some background that I think you needed to hear on that, and I'll be glad to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Olson?
If there's no further questions,
Senator Lilly had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I do have a question, and it's relating to page number 4 and relating to the change from mailing to a business documents or information, from that to attempting to provide contact. What is the intent of the Secretary of State's office as far as contacting these businesses, and what are the ramifications if they are not notified correctly? What happens to those businesses or those entities in that case, Mr. Chair?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator Lilly. With respect to email, the attempt to provide language is really geared towards email. The email addresses are going to be provided to us by the entities themselves, whether it's by the officers of the entity or their registered agent. We're going to get the information from them. With email, it's not always possible to get proof that it was, in fact, received and delivered. And so that's why the attempt to provide language is in there. We will certainly keep a record of to which addresses we sent the email. With respect to the consequences, it certainly is true that just like a mailed notice, these notices are usually sent at the point where the organization has, for example, missed the filing of an annual report or some other required filing, or they have not replaced a registered agent that they are required to have by law, who perhaps resigned or went out of business or moved to another state or whatever. And so those are requirements that business entities and various business entities have in Minnesota. In order to use non-U.S. mail notice in the same way as the U.S. mail, I mean, if we sent them the mail notice to their address that we had on file, which they also give us, we send it by first-class mail, but it's not certified. So the consequence is really the same as if we had sent them by U.S. mail and they took no action. So it's certainly not meant to give any less protection to the corporation, but it is a consequence of, number one, having these requirements, and which have been in law for many, many years, and number two, for being able to move to some kind of an electronic notice.
Okay. Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair, it just feels uncomfortable that there are so many security for emails, the protections and things like that. The email could go to the trash, different things. So I just caution the Secretary of State's office to make sure that we're exerting due diligence or due effort in trying to contact them. With the mail, it feels a little more secure, a little more positive. There's that response coming back of a return piece of mail if they're out of business or something has changed. Where with an email, we really don't have any system to say, yes, someone actually received that notification. So.
Right. Yes, sir.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Lilly, I would just say this would apply to those companies which agree to be notified by email. So they have to agree to be notified by email in the first place.
Thank you. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move that Senate File 1,234, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Judiciary.
Senator Olson moves that Senate File 1,234, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Mr. Black and Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We're going to move one more bill here, and I believe that's going to be Senator Wieger's Senate File 1266.
Mr. Chair, could we do 1270 first?
Sure.
Geospatial. Mr. Chair, I have two agency bills that I believe are considered technical and non-controversial in that spirit. 1270 looks at some technical changes to the Geospatial Advisory Council, and to explain those changes, you are now going to meet the Chief Geospatial Information Officer for Minnesota, David Arbiet.
Thank you.
Please state your name and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Arbeit. I am State's Geospatial Information Officer, and I direct the Office of Geospatial Information Office, Minnesota Geospatial Information Office. In 2009, the legislature authorized this office, which extended the historical role of the Land Management Information Center and codified in law responsibilities to coordinate the emerging technology, geospatial information technologies, which include all of the automated mapping things that you see commercially like Google and MapQuest, but also has become embedded in pretty much every state agency's business activities as well as around the state. So our role has been to coordinate those activities, really the investments that are being made by state agencies to promote collaboration and to provide for coordinated initiatives rather than independent initiatives. And since we've been formally in place July 1, 2009, we've really been quite successful in a number of areas. The original legislation was fairly comprehensive, but there were a few aspects of it that over the last year and a half we found really could stand just some minor attention. So the three areas here, and actually are we talking about the author's
amendment? Yes, and I have an author's amendment, Mr. Chair, that to put the subsequent text.
Senator Wigger moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
Thank you.
Amendment prevails.
So the A1 amendment principally deals with subdivision 8, which specifies the manner in which our advisory structure is put in place. The advisory structure is essential to our ability to represent interests not only of state agencies but around the state. And there are two advisory councils that we depend on. One is a state government advisory council, which is comprised entirely of state agencies and focuses on state agency collaboration. And the other is a statewide council, which deals with stakeholder interests statewide. And the subjects that they deal with overlap, but it's important to us to keep them separate. The amendment here, or the legislation here, amends the manner in which the appointments are made to those councils. Actually, it really only affects the state government council, which originally was specified as having to go through the state open appointments process. So the language here, which is in subdivision 8, section B, does a couple of things. Mainly what it does is it takes the state agency council out of that, doesn't require it to go through that process, but has instead the agencies being designated by the Commissioner of Administration. And then later in subdivision C, it has the members who represent each of those agencies being appointed by the agency commissioners, so that we don't have it basically streamlining the process for appointing those members. In subdivision A, section A, we've simply added tribal governments to the list of stakeholder entities on the statewide council, which was an oversight in the original bill. We actually have a tribal representative on the existing advisory council. And then in section E, it extends the life of the council from 2011 to 2015. Initially, there was a sunset date put in there, which I think is standard practice. The other thing that it does is it repeals Section 2, Where is it? I thought it eliminated the need for a report, but I guess it doesn't do that. Yes. Oh, yes, it does. And the repealer eliminates a subdivision which requires submission of a report in January 2010. That report was submitted as required.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, you mentioned streamlining the process, and I thought you said that you took it out of the state's open appointment process, but it appears that it has to be in compliance with that.
No,
Mr. Arbeit.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Olson. In Section B on the author's amendment, it says that, where does it say this now? Yeah, the states, it does say in Section C, it does continue to say that members of the statewide geospatial advisory council.
Line 30.
Yeah, in line 30. In line 29, that the statewide geospatial advisory council must be selected in compliance with the open appointments process. That actually is no change from current practice. In line 30, it says members of the state government advisory council must be appointed by the heads of their respective agencies. The state agency representatives don't have to go through that process.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, that concludes our testimony. I don't believe there's any opposition. And would
want to move your bill?
Move the bill, and it would go
recommended
to the floor.
To a pass. Senator Wigger moves Senate File 1270, as amended, be recommended to pass. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. We're going to move on to Senate File 1266. As Senator Wigger said, this will be shorter.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senate File 1266 has a couple of author's amendments. It relates the subject to the resource recovery program, and this has gone out for bid, and we have a contract now that is reflected in the changes. To explain, I'll have an agency representative introduce himself, and then there's an author's amendment, which I'll ask you to explain since I don't know if
counsel's
put it in.
Is this an oral one, or do you have one written? Author's amendment?
Okay.
It's an oral amendment?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. The oral amendment, I'm going to deliver that to counsel. And I'll offer that right now, and then we'll refer to that.
Senator Wigger offers an oral author's amendment.
Which Mr. Bodern will reflect. It's the red language.
Mr. Bodern.
Mr. Chairman, there are two small changes that would be in Section 2 of the bill. And let's see. Getting a look at this for the first time here. Page 2, line 3, reinstate the stricken by weight. And then on page 2, line 10, delete in the metropolitan area.
To the author's oral amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Prevails. Senator Wigger.
Okay, please proceed.
Chairman Perry, members of the committee, my name is Dave Fielding. I'm the Director of Plant Management. In the summer of 2010, we went out for bids on our resource recovery operation located here on the Capitol Complex. At the conclusion of that process, the contract, of which the state, I should add, the state was a bidder, the state awarded the contract to a rehabilitative service provider here in the metro area, Accessibility, Inc. In the first week of September of last year, we closed the State Resource Recovery Center. That operation now has been provided by the third-party provider for all of our Capitol Complex operations since that time. These changes to Statute 115A.15 are the administrative changes that are necessary to reflect that change in operations, the reduction in the staff that resulted from that. Rather than try to go through this, I know we're in a hurry. I can certainly stand for any questions that you may have.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, does that mean that facility has been closed where you could go and shop and reuse in other offices what the really good stuff that other people have thrown away?
Mr. Fielding.
Senator Olson, no, that operation now is at our Arden Hills Surplus Fleet and Surplus Services facility.
Long way to go now.
Mr. Chair, I apologize, but in the spirit of agency discussion with other stakeholders, we have one additional amendment, which would, I believe, put it in the form where everyone is feeling good about
the bill.
Is
this another oral amendment?
Yes, which is just being presented to Mr. Bodern.
Senator Wigger offers an oral amendment If you could help us out, Mr. Botter.
So, Mr. Chairman, then on page 2 of the bill, reinstate on line 26, reinstate the stricken paragraph B. And then on page 2, lines 31 through line 3.1, reinstate the stricken language. And then this gets a little complicated, but it's fairly simple in the end. On page 2, line 31, after commissioner, insert of the pollution control agency.
And I would so move that, and again, thank you for accommodating that, and I do have some testimony after we put that on.
All those in favor on the Wigger
Mr. Chair,
oral? Yes, Senator
Verification, I don't understand what counsel just walked us through. I don't understand the changes.
Mr. Bodern, would you repeat that?
So, please? Mr. Chairman, I think first I'll describe what it does. Basically, at the bottom of page 2 and on over to the very top of page 3, you'll see the duties here that are being stricken that were assigned to the Commissioner of Administration, I believe. They are now being reassigned. They're being reinstated and assigned to the Commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency.
So, Senator Daley, if you take the stricken lines out and add after commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency, all that from line 2.31 through 3.1 would all be reinstated.
Thank you.
Senator Olson.
Chairman, the Pollution Control Agency is going to get into reducing waste generation and waste reduction stuff?
Senator Wigger.
Mr. Chair, I'll introduce Trudy Richter.
Ms. Richter, please state your name for the record.
Thank you. Trudy Richter, I'm here on behalf of the Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. We've worked with the Department of Administration and the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency to clarify that this is a task that's more appropriate for the Pollution Control Agency to audit the performance of the Department of Administration as it relates to measuring their progress on the recycling goal. It's an auditing function, and also assisting in technical advice to increase recycling, et cetera.
Sure. On the oral amendment, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Amendment prevails. Any
further
testimony?
I would renew my motion that
Senator Wigger
1266 as amended be recommended to pass.
Mr.
Senator,
Chair.
Just a minute. Senator Wigger renews his motion that Senate file number 1266 as amended be recommended to pass. Senator Daley.
To go back to a previous oral amendment, in the metropolitan area on line 2.10, was that stricken?
Yes.
2.10. Mr. Chairman, Senator Daley, that's correct.
That's
do
correct.
We then, what is the consequence of leaving in line 2.13 in the metropolitan area? Does that need to remain, or should that be stricken as well? What is the impact when we strike in the metropolitan area in line 2.10, but we don't in 2.13.
Mr. Fielding.
Chairman Perry and Senator Daley, that was stricken at the request of pollution control because they wanted it to be statewide as opposed to limiting it to the metropolitan area.
Did that answer, or are you saying that on line 2.13, where it says each state agency in the metropolitan area, is that what you're questioning?
Just trying to clarify what the impact is of the amendment when we strike in the metropolitan area on line 2.10 and we don't on 2.13.
Correct. Mr. Bodern, would you have an idea of what that?
Mr. Chairman, I think you may want to ask the agency first
right.
What's intended.
Mr. Fielding?
Chairman Perry, I have to defer to Pollution Control, who I worked with closely in reviewing this, and the change that we've made here reflects their input. They did not, I understand the question, but they did not make any distinction on that. So I hesitate to make a decision in their behalf.
Senator Daley.
Mr. Chair, knowing what little we know at this point, I would recommend, based on the little information we do have, that we strike in the metropolitan area on line 2.13 as well.
Let me suggest this. Senator Wigger, would this be something you could find out between now and when we come back tonight at 6, and maybe we just lay it over and do it
right out of the chute tonight, because I think everything else is okay.
Yeah, I appreciate Senator Daley the inquiry, and that's an excellent suggestion. So let's lay it over, and anyone else with questions, and we'll be back at 6. I will be in committee, another committee, until that time, but we'll multitask.
All right. We're going to lay Senate file 1266 on the table. Members, we will be back. It sounds like we have some other committees. Let's make it 6:10.
Yeah, I'll get it.
And.
Sure.